Good to be with each of you tonight. We're going to continue our Old Testament overview. And when we left off last time, we were just starting to look at the book of Ezra. And when it comes to the history of the Israelites, and you're dividing it up into the various sections of their history, what kind of time frame are we in? When we get to Ezra, where are the Jews located? What's been going on? What are some of the big events that has just happened? Say again, Dave? Yeah, return from captivity. But did all the Jews return? No, there's still a good number that stayed behind in Persia. Remember, it was the Babylonian captivity, but then the Persians conquered the Babylonians, and so it became the Persian Empire. And so while they're in some of the same places as they were before, it's considered Persia at that point. And in fact, when we get to the book of Esther, we'll see the fact that there are still plenty of Jews staying back behind in Persia. But the captivity has come to an end at the beginning of this book. And if you take a look at Ezra chapter 1 and verse 1, it says, "Now in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom and also put it in writing, saying," and then we have recorded for us what he said, which is basically, "God's told me to let all you go back home, and you go back to your land, go back to your cities, rebuild the temple, and be established back in your own country." Now, does that mean that the Jews were free from the government of Persia? No, they still had to answer to Persia. They were still a vassal state. They still would send tribute and so forth, but they weren't their own sovereign nation at that point. But they were free to go back home. By the way, I don't believe I asked this question, but why on earth would Cyrus do this? What advantage does that give him? If any, I mean, you've got conquered peoples. Why would you send them back home when there is a possibility of, by sending them back home, that they're going to rebel against you? Had no choice in what way? Okay, well, yeah, okay. Obviously, God was going to make sure it happened regardless. From a political standpoint, what would have been the reason behind it? If you take God out of the equation, would there be any advantage to that? It's a good PR move, and allows more production. And so there may be that behind it as well. In the Cyrus cylinder that I showed you that's on display in the British Museum, it doesn't go into the same details as with a decree as this does about God being the one behind it. In fact, he attributes Marduk, the Babylonian god, the Persian, one of the main Persian gods, to being the one who's in control. But in any case, ultimately it goes back to God doing this for his people. And this goes back to the promises that God had made to his people hundreds of years prior, that he would restore them back to the land. The captivity was not going to be forever. So that's where we are in the greater context, is they are about to return home. This issue has been decreed, and so they're on their way back home, or about to. And who is it in the first half of the book of Ezra that leads the first return of captives back to Judah? Zerubbabel. It's not Ezra. Ezra doesn't come onto the scene until chapter 7. But it's Zerubbabel who is the one that leads them back home. So let's take a look at an outline of the book of Ezra from a very simple standpoint. In chapters 1 through 6, you have the first return under Zerubbabel, which would have taken place around 538 BC. This would have been just a year or two at the most after Cyrus says, "You may go home." And so it may have even started that same year, but scholars are kind of unsure exactly which year it was. 538, 539, I've seen both figures given. But first return underneath is Zerubbabel. And then the second half of the book, which is chapters 7 through 10, you have a second return, this time under Ezra. And this took place in 458 B.C. Now you can see there's a big gap of years there, almost 60 years difference between the first six chapters and the last half of the book. Why is that gap there? What's taking place in that gap? Anybody know? You do, you just don't know it. The story of Esther. The story of Esther takes place between chapters 6 and 7. That's a whole other book that we'll be taking a look at next week. And I've got on there that the story of Esther is from 479 until don't know when B.C. 479 is when she would have become queen. That is pretty sure dating there. But the events of the book of Esther, we don't know exactly how long that took. Now, the king that she was married to, King Xerxes, or Ahasuerus, as he's also known, his reign ended in 465. But we don't know just how long the events of Esther took place. But in between chapters 6 and 7 of Ezra, that's when you plug in the book of Esther. Okay. All right? Now, we're going to be taking a look at Nehemiah in just a moment, but let's go ahead and talk about Ezra. Last week, I introduced you to a controversy at the end of class and told you to be researching it, thinking about it, reading up on it. And I know that every single one of you did that, so we should have lots of good discussion here. And that question was about Cyrus the Great, who is the one that conquered Babylon and is mentioned there in Ezra chapter 1, who is the king of Persia. But if you go back to Daniel chapter 5 with me, please, we have a different king named Daniel 5. Daniel 5 is a story of Belshazzar, who was the crown prince acting king of Babylon at the time. Daniel's lifetime, obviously. And this is the story of the handwriting on the wall. He's feasting. By the way, what is he using to eat off of and drink out of in that feast? Yeah, various articles from the temple in Jerusalem. Why would a king of Babylon do that with all the stuff from the temple in Jerusalem? Disrespect. Yeah, we're greater than you are, and so now we're going to use all that stuff that was used in the temple, I'm going to use it in my feast and brag kind of a thing. And so I don't think it's any coincidence that it's during that kind of event in feasting and pride of Belshazzar that God comes to him with this vision of the handwriting on the wall and saying, this very night, your kingdom is going to be taken from you. And sure enough, it was. And if you look at the very end of Daniel 5 in verse 30, it says, that very night, Belshazzar, king of the Chaldeans, was slain, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. Not Cyrus. Darius the Mede. And you can research through all kinds of history books and the stories of the Persian Empire, and you'll never see Darius in there because it was Cyrus that became king of Babylon at that point. He was the king of Persia, conquered the Babylonian Empire. In fact, does anybody know from history how Cyrus and his armies were able to come into Babylon and defeat the Babylonians that night? It's a really cool story. Jimmy? Okay, the Euphrates River flowed right through the center of town. Okay, the town was built on both sides of the banks of the Euphrates River. Large river. And so they simply diverted the river. And then they were able to walk right on in. Didn't have to use battering rams or build a siege or anything. Pretty smart. And this happened right here. But it was Cyrus, not Darius the Mede. And obviously, In Ezra, Cyrus is the one named. And we have the Cyrus Cylinder. And I mean, he's well attested in history. So the question is, who is Darius the Mede? Why does Daniel say it's Darius the Mede instead of Cyrus, the king of Persia? And so what is a possible explanation for that? There are a few. Anybody read up on this, get any possible explanations? Okay, there was a military general who became governor for a very short period of time. And his name was Gaburu, if I'm pronouncing that right. I'm sure it sounded a whole lot different in Persian than it does in Southern English. But Gaburu was Cyrus's general, and it could be that this Darius is another name for this individual who was set up as the one to oversee that particular area of the kingdom. That is one explanation you will hear given from time to time. What's another explanation? Does anybody know? Jimmy? Okay. So you're saying Darius would be a co-regent or something with Cyrus? Okay. That's possible. The problem is that Darius, that name, Darius the Mede, is never even found anywhere in any records at all. Now, let me just say this. Why is that not necessarily a big deal, especially when it comes to the book of Daniel? Because for hundreds of years, nobody knew who Belshazzar was. And people said, well, Belshazzar, Daniel got it wrong, or the author of Daniel got it wrong, because there was no Belshazzar that was king. But lo and behold, in your lifetimes, some of you, depending on how old you are, archaeological discovery of some things that had Belshazzar's name, and he was the crown prince. He wasn't necessarily the one that was truly the king, but he was acting as king while his father was off gallivanting around all over the country. And so there was a Belshazzar. So could it be that Darius is another individual that we don't know about yet? That is a possibility. I would say it's probably the most unlikely of the possibilities, but it is a possibility. Okay. That would not be different. That would be a different co-regent or something with Cyrus. But there's no evidence that that's the case yet. Anybody else know of any other explanation? Okay, I heard two or three. We'll start with you. What was that? Okay, that is actually the same person as Cyrus, just a different name, a different title. And here's where I think this explanation makes a lot of sense, and it was first proposed in 1947, I think, and has gained momentum, and that is that both Darius and Cyrus are not actually personal names. Those are titles. There were more than one Cyrus, just like Artaxerxes actually was a title as well. And Pharaoh was a title as well. And so Darius could have been one of the titles, Cyrus been another title. That is a possibility. I'll say more about that in just a moment. But I heard some other explanation. Were you the one that said something? Okay, the same person. Okay, Lisa? Yeah, Darius the Mede is different than Darius the Great. She brings up a good point there. There were other Dariuses. In fact, there's a Darius in Ezra and Nehemiah, at least in Ezra. It's different Darius because different time frame. But then again, if you're looking at it as a title, just like Pharaoh, then you can see why there would be more than one. Okay. I lean to this explanation that it was probably the same person, that you'd have a title. Remember, he was king over both Persia and Babylon now, and he was also from the Medes as well. He had both lineages in him. He was both Mede and Persian from lineage standpoint, from his parents. And so one could have been the Persian name, one could have been the Mede name. And that is a likely explanation, because we know that various kings had more than one title, went by more than one name. Also, Cyrus was, in fact, about 62 years old when he conquered Babylon. We know that he was around 60. Daniel 5 says that that Darius the Mede was 62 years old when he received the kingdom. So, why do I bring this up? Why is this important for you to know? This is one of the many things that skeptics will point to and say, see, the Bible doesn't get it right. There was no Darius. That's what they said about Belshazzar. And whether or not there was a completely different individual named Darius that we don't know about yet, or whether or not it's the same person, just different name, there is a logical explanation for this. And you need to be aware of the controversies and be able to trust that the Bible is true. Even when you may not know all the answers, you can know some of it. And even if you didn't know all that, then when you read Daniel and you come up with one name of a king receiving the kingdom, and then you read Ezra and it's a different person, you're going to have questions as to, huh? Okay, who's right? Well, they're both right. Okay. All right, questions, comments about that? Okay. So let's talk about some of the passages in Ezra that are of importance. And again, the book of Ezra just focuses on two of the three returns made from captivity back to Judah. And let's go to Ezra chapter 3 to begin with. Ezra chapter 3. Zerubbabel is the one that leads them back, and he's in charge of doing what? What is his mission while he's there? To rebuild the temple. And so they lay the foundation of the temple, and take a look at verse 12 of Ezra 3. Actually, it's back up to verse 10. When the builders laid the foundation of the temple of the Lord, the priests stood in their apparel with trumpets, and the Levites, the sons of Asaph, with cymbals, to praise the Lord according to the ordinance of David, king of Israel. And they sang responsively, praising and giving thanks to the Lord, for he is good, for his mercy endures forever toward Israel. Then all the people shouted with a great shout when they praised the Lord, because the foundation of the house of the Lord was laid. Little side note here, in verse 11 it says they sang responsively. What does that mean? Yeah, you'd have a leader or a group that would say one thing, and then you have another section that would say one thing or sing back. We did that here when I was we didn't sing it, but when I was reading through some of the Psalms, there's one Psalm in particular that every other line would be the response of the congregation to the leader who was singing it or reading it. And I had y'all respond back to me with that line. And while we don't do it in the same format that they did it, we do it with many songs today where you have the women sing one part and the men might answer it, might say the same thing, might be completely different, but we're responding back and forth. That's what that's talking about there. So you have them lay the foundation and they're blowing the trumpets and giving thanks and singing. But look at verse 12. But many of the priests and Levites and heads of the fathers' houses, old men who had seen the first temple, wept with a loud voice when the foundation of this temple was laid before their eyes. Yet many shouted aloud for joy, so that the people could not discern the noise of the shout of joy from the noise of the weeping of the people, for the people shouted with a loud shout, and the sound was heard afar off. Two things about this. It says that there were many of the older generation that had seen the first temple. Now, remember, this first return is in 538 BC. When was the destruction of the temple? What year? 586 BC. That was the third time that Nebuchadnezzar came in to the area, and it was the final straw for him with these rebellious Jews. So 586 BC, here we are 538 BC, almost 50 years later since the destruction, And so these men had seen the first temple and obviously had been old enough for it to make an impression on them and for them to remember it. So they're 60, 70, 80 years old at this point. And they've been in captivity. Well, I don't know if they've been in captivity only the 50 years. They could have come over. Some of these could have come over in one of the earlier captivities. But in any case, these are the older men that had seen the first temple before it was destroyed in 586. Yeah, well, they... Are you talking about the second temple that they're doing or the first temple? Yeah. The second temple, they would have... There was a temple complex even with the first temple. The second temple, and it says just the foundations. I don't even know exactly how complete that was or how big it was. But it would have been, I think, I would take that to be that the foundation of the entire complex was laid. Then again, it could have been just the foundation of the temple itself, the actual temple, and they hadn't gotten to the complex yet. I don't know. But why does it say, here's the second thing, why does it say that these old men that had seen the first temple, why did they cry? It said they wept. Wept very loudly, so much so that because the noise was so great, you couldn't tell who was shouting for joy and who was weeping out loud. The glory of the old temple. Who built the old temple? Solomon. And if you go back in your memories to the description of the old temple, what is the one material that comes to your mind? Gold. Because almost everything was overlaid with gold. And think about those big doors going into the temple. Which way were they facing? Say it louder. Facing east, sun rises up over the hill on the eastern side of Jerusalem that we know in the New Testament as the Mount of Olives, over the Kidron Valley. And so the sun rises up and it hits those golden doors and it's shining brightly. And not just the doors, but the columns are overlaid with gold. Everything outside is brass and gold, and it's... And you've got wealth everywhere, inside and outside of that temple. The glory of Solomon's temple was never going to be duplicated again. And I think that these people realize that they're people are happy that, yes, the temple is being rebuilt, but it's not like the old temple. It's not like back in the good old days, in the golden years. That was a funny pun joke there you're supposed to laugh at. Thank you very much. Okay, so, one of those corny preacher jokes. You'll get used to them eventually. Yet many shouted for joy, and the mixture of the two was so loud you couldn't tell the difference between the two. Go to Ezra 7. We're going to skip ahead to the second part now, the second half of the book. Zerubbabel has many stoppages in work because of opposition. Haggai and Zechariah are commissioned by God to prophesy to them and to stir them up to finish the work that they had begun. It takes a long time to finish the temple because of the stoppages in work.
Before we get too far away, mm-hmm. when you really stop and think, the temple that they saw was 400 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Or God preserved that building, one or the other. Because 400-year-old buildings,
yeah.
a modern-day concrete structure will crumble and wash into the nearest gully if it's not maintained within 70 years.
I think that both of those equations come into play. that it was maintained throughout the years, but certainly God had his hand in that. Because when you take a look at the reforms of both Josiah and Hezekiah, the two greatest kings in Judah, part of their reform was to repair the temple. They had gone into disarray. They had been neglected. And so just by natural causes is going to decay. But also because it had been desecrated and used for idolatrous worship as well. And so remember, it was when they were cleaning out the temple that Josiah's men found the book of the law, which enacted even greater reforms. And so under the wicked kings, it didn't get destroyed, but it certainly wasn't in its tip-top shape. But there were periods in their history where they did repair the temple, but ultimately God was letting it stand until he was done with it. But yeah, 400 years old, and still they recognized the glory of it, and that this one was not going to compare. Any other comments before we move on? Okay, so they finally finished the temple, and now we're into the second return under Ezra that came much later, almost, 60 years later or so, 70 years later. And let's take a look at Ezra 7 and verse 10. Here's the mission of Ezra. By the way, what was his background? What tribe and what did he do? He was a scribe, which means what? We use that versions of that word, that root word in our things today. What does it have to do with? Yeah, copying, writing. Okay, so he was well educated, and what would he be writing? Yeah, the law. He'd be writing copies of the law and things to do with religious services and copies of the law and so forth. And then he was what else? He was a priest. So that means he was from the tribe of Levi. Okay. And Ezra 7 and verse 10, it says, "For Ezra had prepared his heart to seek the law of the Lord and to do it and to teach statutes and ordinances in Israel." So he wasn't coming to help with the physical rebuilding. What was he coming for? The spiritual rebuilding of the people. Temple had been built, but they needed help spiritually. They needed some spiritual leadership. And as a priest and as a scribe, he was well fit for the job, and he made it his purpose. He prepared his heart, it says, to seek the law of the Lord. He was going to do it first. He was going to make sure he was right with God, that he was doing what God said. And then he was going to teach others to do it. If there's not a better prescription for how we ought to be living our lives and sharing it with others, I don't know what else there is. That should be every one of us right there, is preparing our heart to seek the law of the Lord, to do it ourselves, and then to teach statutes and ordinances in spiritual Israel. Great, great commentary on what his mission was. And that's really what we see for the rest of the book, is him fulfilling this and doing this work right here. Okay? All right, questions, comments on that? Let's go to Ezra chapter 9. One of the things he has to deal with in his spiritual rebuilding of the people and of the nation of Israel is that there were some sins they were involved in that needed correction. And in Ezra 9 and 10, they had intermarried with pagans, with people from other countries that were not Jews. Why on earth is that a big deal? Okay, God told them not to, so, you know, because I said so. You know, I know kids don't want to hear that, but sometimes it's just a matter of because I said so. But what led them into captivity in the first place? This kind of stuff, being involved in idolatry, and where did the temptation for idolatry come from? Marrying pagans. And who started the ball rolling in that? Solomon. Okay. And it was because of that that the kingdom was split. The northern kingdom never recovered. Southern kingdom was mostly bad, only a few good kings, only a few periods of their history that they were not idolatrous. And even when underneath Josiah, arguably the greatest king of the southern kingdom, Jeremiah makes the point that even then, underneath Josiah's reforms, it was just surface. It wasn't from the heart. And so this is where it started, was with them marrying pagans, and those wives or those men turning their hearts from Yahweh. Okay, let me ask you this, because this is an important distinction that we need to make, that you understand. Was it wrong for them to marry someone that was not a Jew? Yeah, not if that person was a proselyte, Lisa says. Can you think of a famous woman in Old Testament history? Actually, two of them come to my mind right off the bat, that were not Jews, and both of them are in the lineage of Christ. Rahab and Ruth. Okay, Rahab was a Canaanite, and what was Ruth? A Moabite. So it's not that it was wrong, that it was violating God's covenant, God's laws, to marry someone that was not a Jew. It was if they're pagan and have no desire to turn from their paganism. They're not going to proselytize to Judaism. That was the distinction. Okay. So in chapter 9, Ezra comes, and lo and behold, there are people, verse 1, the leaders came to me saying, the people of Israel and the priests and the Levites, look at that. It's not just the people. It's the priests and the Levites. They have not separated themselves from the peoples of the lands with respect to the abominations of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites, the Ammonites, the Moabites, the Egyptians, and the Amorites. For they have taken some of their daughters as wives for themselves and their sons, so that the holy seed is mixed with the peoples of those lands. Indeed, the hand of the leaders and rulers has been foremost in this trespass. Of all people, who should have known better? The priests and the Levites, right? Because those are supposed to be the religious leaders. They're the ones that are supposed to know the law. And yet they're the ones that were foremost in this trespass. And so verse 3, when he heard this thing, Ezra says, I tore my garment and my robe and plucked out some of the hair of my head and beard and sat down astonished. Now I have, from time to time, plucked out a stray hair that was unruly, that just I could not get to do what I wanted it to do, or it was one big bleached blonde hair sticking up that looked out of place. I don't know why my wife is laughing, but and so I pull that out, a little bit twing, tinge, no big deal. I don't get the picture that's what Ezra was doing, though. One little hair at a time. Now, he's yanking his hair out, and we speak figuratively of pulling our hair out. Our kids want to make us pull our hair out at times. But not only that, but, his beard, too. Can you imagine that, Tom? Have you ever done that with your beard? No. That's how distraught he is. He's pulling his hair out, literally. And so chapters 9 and 10 cover this problem. What's the solution that they propose? And Ezra says, yes, that is the correct solution. And that's what you need to do. Get rid of those pagan spouses, and not just the spouses, the children. Okay. You want to talk about commitment to wanting to do what's right? You want to talk about repentance and what repentance looks like? That's here in chapter 10. Because you're talking about people who even, yes, back then, they loved those wives just like and those husbands, just like we do today. And yet because this